So welcome all. As you know, this is the first of 10 lectures that Nimar Kanihamed and I will be giving. Yes, I know it's 10 lectures, that sounds a lot. But it's really not a lot when you try to think everything that we would like to explain, especially given the ambitious title of the course, right? We're just going to try to derive space-time quantum mechanics from scattering amplitudes, okay? Well, I think it's each lecture is supposed to be 1.5 hours. I think that I got that. Is that right? Okay. Very good. Very good. Just set 1 hour, I would be in trouble. Okay. So presumably expect the today's lecture in the afternoon to be slightly longer than that, but let you know. Okay. Very good. So let me start by giving you some motivation. And then I'll give you an overview of the course. And then we will do a little bit more boring things like kinematics, but we have to learn the language that we're going to be using so that that will be necessary. So let me start giving you some motivation and telling you what we're going to be studying. We're going to be studying the S matrix of theories. In asymptotically flat space-times, okay? So imagine our Penrose diagram of Minkowski space. So we prepare some in-state and some out-state. And we're interested in computing the transition probability for the S-matrix defined in this form. Of course, we know that we're not very interested in computing the full S-matrix. We are not interested in the part that is just an entity. So we usually define the T matrix, or I would like to call it the M matrix, because we're going to denote everything by M, and this will be the object we would like to compute, or that we would like to study. Very good. So you would say, what's interesting about this? We all learned this in quantum field theory. Well, the way you learn this in quantum field theory, yeah, now I feel at home with the noise, I think. My office is next to the construction, so it's like, Now I can fully concentrate. Yeah. Okay, very good. So we usually learn this in quantum field theory and in perturbation theory. We compute this using Feynman diagrams. Okay, which we get from a Lagrangian. Now, all the Lagrangians we know and love have a very particular property, and which is that they make interactions, or they make the physics in space-time be manifestly local. So all the Lagrangians we write are manifestly local. They have only local interactions. We know that when we discuss gauge theories and gravity, we pay a price for that. The price we pay is introducing a large amount of redundancy, and thus the gauge redundancy in gauge theory, and diffeo invariance in gravity, okay? But then locality is manifest, okay? So that's something we take for granted, and we're very happy with that. Now, I would like to mention a couple of more things that we also take for granted, which are completely made manifest by this way of describing the S matrix, which are going to be completely obscure in the way I'm going to present today. Of describing the S matrix. One of them is particles. Well, whenever we talk about the S matrix, we are used to say, well, experimentalists prepare particles. They send particles and they measure particles. So particles are things that are manifest in this description. Okay. What else? Well, unitarity can also be made manifest in this description. That's what Feynman tried very hard to do, and he succeeded. And what else can we make manifest in this description? Well, I think this is very good. Well, we could also choose Feynman diagrams to make Lorentz invariants manifest. Okay, very, very good. Now, what is the purpose of these lectures, or what has been the main motivation of studying and going back to the S-matrix? Well, at first, it was motivated by the fact that in the 60s, people tried to construct, people didn't have, or before the 60s, people were not, were still deciding between quantum field theory and a completely S-matrix theoretic way of thinking about physics in space-time. And they were thinking about computing the S-matrix as an independent object from its analytic structures. Okay. Now, what we're going to, what I'm going to present to you today, or during these lectures, is actually going to be different from this point of view, even, because there they were assuming many of these things here. In particular, they were assuming locality in the form of the structure of the singularities of the S-matrix, and they were using very heavily unitarity. Okay. Now, what we're going to do today is to introduce a new formulation. For the S-matrix. For the S-matrix of what? Well, what seems to be the nicest setup is the S-matrix of massless theory, of massless particles. And up to now, the best understood S-matrix is that of a theory called N equals 4 super Young means. Of course, we all think that presumably N equals, say, supergravity is actually simpler than this one, but probably in the right way of thinking about it. And at the moment, we don't know what it is. But in these lectures, we will concentrate on N equals 4 super Young means. Now, why looking for a new formulation? Why shouldn't we be happy with Feynman diagrams? Well, let me just give an example, a historical example. I'm not claiming that this is going to be exactly like that, but it's just to motivate the search for new formulations. Imagine you have Newton's equations, okay? Well, Newton's equations make manifest that classical mechanics is deterministic. Okay? However, we can also give a new formulation of Newton's equations, which is the Hamiltonian. Or we could give the Lagrangian formulation. Okay? Now, this is just a reformulation of the same physics. There is nothing new in it, right? However, this doesn't make deterministic evolution is not manifest. It's somehow an output of the formalism. Well, we all know that this formulation is quite nice because making determinism not a manifest property is something that allows you to make a leap into quantum mechanics. Okay? So the moral of the story. Yes, what I mean is that the setup of the variational principle explores all possible paths. Yeah, Hamilton's equations explore all possible paths.
Yes, definitely. That's why these two are completely equivalent formulations.
Yeah, I'm just puzzled why you say Hamiltonian formulation is not.
Yeah, so you start with the Hamiltonian,
and you also use a variational principle to derive the Hamilton equations.
You can do that. Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. So the moral of the story. But at least the moral of this story is that it's useful to search for new formulations, I want to stress, of successful theories. Okay? Most of the times you probably won't find anything new, but if you're lucky, you might find something interesting. Okay. So, So let's start our overview of the course.
Okay. So what motivated the search for a new formulation or a dual theory. So I'll usually exchange the words new formulation with dual theory. Okay? This dual theory that we're going to find is not the dual in the sense, in the modern sense of the word, where we usually have a parameter that allows you to study the theory in a strong coupling or a weak coupling, and the dual theory usually describes the thing in the opposite regime. This dual theory would actually live in the same regime as the original theory. So in fact, it would be more appropriate to call it a new formulation, but I'll sometimes just say dual theory. So what motivated the search for a dual theory? So in 2005, it was found that there was a new way of thinking or constructing field level the three-level S matrix in Young Mills. Okay? That way of doing it is called the BCFW formulation or the BCFW recursion relations. Okay? So we're going to discuss that. But basically what it says is that you can take a scattering amplitude, let me denote it by a block of M particles, and write it as a linear combination of the same class of on-shell scattering amplitudes, but now with less number of particles, sum over some particular factorization channels. Okay? So if you have m particles here, in the construction, you have to pick up some particles to be special, and you sum over all possible ways of distributing the rest of the particles, making up smaller amplitudes. And this allows you to compute the scattering amplitudes starting from very, very small amplitudes, because you can apply the recursion relations all over and over again on these guys and build it out of very, very small scattering amplitudes. In particular, you can go all the way to three particle amplitudes. Now, I said that this is only over some factorization channels, and you would say, how come that you can get the full answer? Well, the reason is that by this notation, I mean that these particles have suffered a non-local deformation. Okay? So, this way of writing scattering amplitudes is the way, at three level, is a way that gives you the most compact expressions known for these amplitudes. But there is a price you pay. Well, the price you pay is that you don't have so manifest locality is gone. So you get something that we know comes from an evolution through a local spacetime by summing very, very strange objects, objects that look non-local. Okay? So each of them look very, very non-local. And, well, that's the price you pay for getting something that is very compact. So this has been very useful in computations. It has allowed to compute many, many scattering amplitudes. And from the point of view of searching for a new theory, this has allowed the production of lots of data. Okay? This is an analogy that Nima likes to use, but I think it's great. I would have never come out with that thing because he has a phenomenology background. He says that this is great because using these recursion relations, you can produce lots of data, right? And you want to build a theory to model that data. That data is completely well-defined. You can trust it. You can even do it yourself. You know? You don't have to rely on somebody else to tell you, oh, look, here is the plot, and this. No, this is awesome. Very good. Very good. Okay.
Nobody has succeeded in actually doing that. But
it's possible.
It is conceivable. Yeah. It's conceivable. Okay, allow me. All right.
Pretty good. Now, it turns out that in N equals 4 super Youngmans, each BCFW term has been realized to enjoy a remarkable new symmetry. It's called a Youngian symmetry. And this is an infinite dimensional symmetry algebra that acts on each of these BCFW terms. And therefore, the three-level S matrix in N equals 4 super Youngmans enjoys this symmetry. This is completely obscure. It would have been impossible to find it using Feynman diagrams. Each Feynman diagram is not manifestly, it doesn't manifest this symmetry. Okay? So once again, we're starting to see that the BCFW terms are begging to be a new formulation or coming from a new formulation, just like we were saying before. Okay? Pretty good. Now, BCFW terms, or the terms that appear in this in the expansion of any three-level amplitude, are actually examples of a more general kind of objects in N equals 4 super Youngmian called leading singularities. Okay, so we will have, what are these leading singularities? Well, we all know that if we have the S matrix of massless particles, well, at loop level, we will have infrared divergences. So we will have to deal with infrared divergences, right? Well, it turns out that infrared divergences actually come from the choice of contour. If you take the scattering amplitude and choose a different contour, imagine you allow the momentum of the momentum of the internal particles to be complex variables, and think about the integrand as being a rational function, you can now define, say, the residues, the multidimensional residues of these objects. And as multidimensional residues, they don't have infrared singularities. They are completely finite, well-defined objects. So if we think about loop amplitudes, this is a bad notation for the loop momentum because I would like to call the L loop amplitude by L. So let me say, little L would be the loop moment, the number of loops that we're having. Okay, so think about this, not as an integral over R4 to the L, but let's replace it to some integral, by some integral, that is actually an integral over a torus, over four copies of S1 to the L, in such a way that you compute a multidimensional residue. Well, this is something that Nima will explain today, and this is just the overview. But it's clear that the infrared divergences, they come from the choice of contour, where in R4, you're forced to pass through collinear and soft singularities of the integrand. But in these contours, you're not forced to do that. So this produces infrared finite data again. Now, the claim is that any infrared finite data of the S matrix should be something that your dual formulation, here I go again, or the new formulation, should be able to compute for you. Okay? Now, what happens on these contours? Well, in order to get residues, you have to pick up poles of this integrand, right? Just like in any residue computation. And the poles of the integrand are basically locations where the amplitudes factor, right? So we can get, say, at one loop, we can get things like this. You can collect all Feynman diagrams that share four given propagators, and the residue integral will make these particles to be on shell. And this would be an example of a leading singularity at one loop. Now, you could also have two loop leading singularities, and they would be things like this. Okay? And so on. So you have leading singularities at all orders. In perturbation theory. Okay? Clearly, this is a fantastic amount of information about the theory. Of course, can you reconstruct the theory, the full S matrix, just from the leading singularities? Well, that's a different question.
Presumably, the singularities are only dependent on the external momenta. The the integral doesn't depend on which contour you choose, on the internal momentum.
Yes.
But the way you were describing it, it seemed like you were saying it was singularities on the of the internal momentum.
But yes. So,
deformation of the contour shouldn't change the value.
So let's actually write down a one loop example, right? So imagine you have, in this example, imagine you have the total momentum flowing in here is P1, the total momentum here is P2, P3, and P4. So this integral will be integral V4L over L squared, say this is L minus P1 squared, L minus P1 2 squared, where we sum the two momenta here, and L plus P4 squared. Indeed, this is only a function of the external momentum. It cannot depend on L. Now, what I'm saying is that I would like to think about this as an integral where L lives in C4. Sure. The usual loop amplitude is obtained when this contour integral has a contour which is R4. Now, when it's R4, this is full of infrared divergences in general, right? Because we can have collinear singularities and sub-singularities here overlapping. But imagine that we choose a contour which is given by the following. I'm going to solve these equations. Mod of L squared is equal to some small real number, epsilon. Now, the phases of each of these, well, I can make a change of variables and call this U1, U2, U3, and U4. Well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They can be real in Minkowski space. We will complexify them in a moment, but they don't have to be. For this computation, they can be in any signature. They can actually be the actual momentum. Now you define this to be U1, U2, U3, and U4. Now your torus is just made out of the phases of U1, U3, U2, and U3. And the integral becomes an integral dUi over Ui times on Jacobian. Well, it's hard to resist the temptation of defining the residue to be just the Jacobian evaluated at 0, right? Of course, these are non-linear equations, so they might have several solutions. In fact, you can prove that these ones, in general, have two solutions. So there are two locations in C4 where these equations can be satisfied, and you can associate with each of them one leading singularity. So you can imagine that the number of objects that you can produce by performing these integrals is huge. Now, at two loops, just this diagram has, you have to solve all these equations. You have 8 equations to solve for 8 variables, 4 coming from here and 4 coming from here, and you have 4 locations where there is a leading singularity. So you have, with the same diagram, 8 objects that you would like to compute. Okay? Now, the claim is that we have found a dual formulation that computes all those leading singularities to all orders in perturbation theory, everything. So that is what we call the Grassmannian formulation. Well, in order to tell you what the Grassmannian formulation is, I first have to tell you that amplitudes for m particles to scatter in Young Mills or in n equals 4 super Young Mills, they can be separated into classes where k is called the R chart. Or in Young Mills, we can think about k as being the number of gluons with negative helicity. And of course, m minus k would be the number of gluons with positive helicity. Okay? Very good. So, tomorrow we're going to discuss this Grassmannian formulation in detail. But let me just give you a hint of what it is. It's a formulation that describes each of these sectors Now the K and the N will have a very interesting mathematical meaning. This object will be described by what is called the Grassmannian GKN, which is a space of K planes in CN, or the space of K dimensional subspaces in CN, okay? I could say that equivalently by saying K-planes that contain the origin in CN, okay? And the object we will find tomorrow is an integral of this form. I'll just write it today so that when I write it tomorrow, you're not surprised, because you will all know what it is by then. Well, it's an integral over, in order to describe K-planes, in CN, you have to give me K-vectors that span the K-plane. So if you put the K-vectors in a matrix, mathematicians call this a C-matrix, I integrate over the components of this, the minors of the matrix, some minors that I chose for convenience, and I impose some conditions on the K-plane. I say that my C-plane is going to be orthogonal to some particular plane, and is going to contain some particular plane. And these planes will contain the information of the physical data in them. Okay? So all the physical data will be contained the scattering data. Will be contained in planes. Actually in two planes in CN. You see that this is already very, very alien to all of us, right? This is very strange. Physical data contained in two planes in CN. Now, you see why I told you that even the notion of particles is going to be strange, because the dimension of the space, the dimension of the Grassmannian depends on N, which is the number of particles. Okay. So what we're going to find in these lectures. Very good, very good. So here is a claim. Claim. You are supposed to treat this as a contour integral. And as a contour integral, you can compute residues of this contour integral. And residues are in one-to-one correspondence with all the leading singularities of n equals 4 supergenerals. So this simple formula here encodes all leading singularities to all orders in perturbation theory that you can write down in n equals 4 supergenerals in the sector with K and M. Okay. So that is the claim.
It tells you where the leading singularity is.
It gives you the value of the leading singularity. Okay. To construct the leading singularity, you take all possible Feynman diagrams, if you deal with Feynman diagrams, choose all Feynman diagrams that share the same number of propagators, evaluate that sum on this contour, and then you get the product of three-level amplitudes jammed together in this form. And that product is what is called the leading singularity. And the claim is that this object, the residues of this object, compute all those leading singularities. They are in one-to-one correspondence with the set of all possible leading singularities. Moreover, the claim is that this object produces solves a mathematical problem, which is that it produces all Jungian invariants. Okay? This symmetry that we will discover, which is an infinite dimensional symmetry, you could ask, what are the invariants of this, just as a mathematical problem? And we will find that this, the residues of this object are all the Jungian invariants of the Earth, are all the Jung ordered invariants of this algebra. And just as in one dimensions, you have residue theorems, right? For just Cauchy's theorem, you can use to produce relations among residues. In higher dimensions, in higher complex dimensions, you also have residue theorems. And the claim is that the residue theorems produce all the relations among the Jungian invariants. This, by the way, will prove that all leading singularities, not only the ones that come from BCFW, all leading singularities are also Jungian invariant. Okay. So at this point you will say, well,
find you just solve a mathematical problem. You computed things that we don't know if they will construct the full amplitude for you. So doesn't seem very impressive, or that you have gained very much. Well, it is where the hockey stick comes into play. So at some point, we were not very satisfied with that, in the sense that, well, if you have this dual formulation, maybe it's interesting to work hard and find a way of making manifest things that were not that are not manifest in this formulation, which are manifest in the previous formulation. So we started the search for a particle interpretation. Okay. Well, certainly particles here will be very hard to see because they will have to relate Grassmannians with some k and some n to Grassmannians, say, with some k and one less particle or one less dimension. We could also remove a gluon of minus helicity and be left with something like this. Okay? Well, these are operations that in field theory are very natural. We're dealing with massless particles, right? So we can take a soft limit and just get rid of one particle. That is something that is rooted in locality. So we can precisely do that and precisely control the way we extract this, this soft particle. So this would be... So if we find such a thing, it would be the analog of soft limits. Now, it turns out, quite surprisingly, that... Well, it's not, that's not the surprising thing, but that this is not quite the natural operation for mathematicians. Mathematicians would say that the natural operation is actually the other way around, is the inclusion of these spaces in the big one. Okay? And that will lead us into something that we like to call an inverse soft operation, which is definitely much more interesting because it will allow you to construct an amplitude by adding one particle at a time. Okay? Here, you're assuming that you know something about the scattering amplitudes for n particles and going down to n minus 1. But if this was possible, you could go from n minus 1 to n. Okay. Now, this will also solve an interesting problem, which is that I told you that three-level scattering amplitudes can be written in terms of sums of residues of this object, if you follow all the line of logic here, from the fact that all leading singularities are residues of this. BCFW terms are just particular examples of leading singularities, okay? And the three-level amplitude can be written in terms of BCFW terms. It would imply that three-level amplitudes can be written as sums of residues of this strange object, LNK. Now, trying to understand this and put it together, trying to understand how locality emerges from here, how these non-local objects that we use in order to build these BCFW things cancel out in order to give you something local, we'll actually end up defining a contour, or what we can call a tree contour inside the Grassmannian, which is manifestly local, and that will allow us to make an interesting connection to twister string theory, which is a theory that Witten introduced in 2003. To describe scattering amplitudes in n equals 4 supernumeraries. So just out of nowhere, we will find the connection between this and twister string theory, just as a kind of, we like to joke and say that it's kind of an RG flow, because there is a one-parameter deformation that allows you to go from this Grassmannian description to the twister string theory description. Okay, very good. So, as I told you, this was one of the things that Feynman diagrams made manifest, and it's so obvious that we don't even talk about it, right? The notion of particles. Now, we will find I think that would be on Wednesday, this particular interpretation. But still, we have to find a space-time. You have to find how space-time emerges from this object. And the way it's going to happen is going to be very, very interesting. It's actually going to be a residue field. Okay? A residue theorem in Ln and K, okay, will allow us to take BCFW terms and blow them apart. It's kind of a surgery. You take these BCFW terms, you blow them apart in such a way that the non-local pieces will be completely cleanly separated from the local pieces. So we blow them apart into local plus non-local pieces. And the non-local pieces, we will see, cancel cleanly. And the local pieces will come out in a form that is called the CSW expansion of scattering amplitudes. Which was introduced in 2004. And was the first sign that you could write a different expansion from that of Feynman diagrams for scattering amplitudes. But this formulation can actually come from a Lagrangian by choosing a particular gauge. So you choose a gauge, roughly speaking, you choose a gauge in Young Mills, say you go to the Lycon gauge, and you make a field redefinition so that you can get rid of one of the two free particle interactions. And then you're left with something that only has some particular kind of interactions. Actually, you get an infinite number of vertices, but they are vertices that only possess a given kind of interaction, and they give rise to a new way of writing scattering amplitudes, which is called CSW. Which is then, as I said, directly connected to Lagrangians. And therefore, space-time. Okay?
Yes, very good, very good, yes. Each term is blown apart into the bad things and the good things. When you add them together, the bad things cancel manifestly. Okay, so we only have one more thing to find.
And the last thing to find is quantum mechanics. Okay, so up to now it seems that this object produces all, solves this mathematical problem, it does all these nice things, and everything that I've said up to now sounds like it only knows about three level, and it knows about loop level only through these strange leading singularities that most of you probably don't care very much about them, because you'd say, well, if you cannot construct the full amplitude out of them, why would you care?
However, it turns out
that by understanding carefully this operation of removing particles, the one we had here, okay, this way of taking soft limits, we will find something interesting, that if we remove one particle from a three-level amplitude, so this is something we're free to do in statistical mechanics, we do all the time. We choose to trace over part of the system, right? So we could say, well, there is one particle that we don't care very much, or suppose we miss that particle, so we have to trace over all the values of that. Well, it turns out that if you do that for only one particle, you map residues of LNK to residues of LN minus 1K or LN minus 1K minus 1, as I said there. Very good. But something very interesting happens if you try to remove two particles at the same time. when you remove two particles at the same time, let me denote it like this. So here, you're choosing to trace over one of the particles. It turns out that if you choose to take your classical object and remove and trace over two particles, there is an operation that you can do in the way you remove them that we call entanglement. Just to be provocative, we don't know if it has anything to do with entanglement, really, but it sounds like entanglement because it's a particular way of defining the contour of integration where you choose to integrate over these two particles in such a way that somehow you generate a new symmetry in the labels of these particles. So it looks like entanglement. And now, somehow you take this entanglement and you try to hide it by identifying these two particles. So you identify these two particles, you get rid of these two particles by this entanglement way of doing it, and this turns out to reproduce all loop amplitudes. Okay? The full loop amplitudes, everything, to all orders in perturbation theory. So that's quite surprising. So out of nowhere, just by removing two particles at the time, so if you do only two particles, you get the one loop. If you remove four particles, you can get two loops and so on. Now, this turns out to be the way we will get to this is actually by doing something similar to BCFW, but at loop level. Yes.
Because you're identifying two values, n plus 3?
Yes, yes.
Three amplitude for n plus 3, and then I do some magic and it turns into a loop amplitude.
Yes, yes, indeed. You start with an amplitude with more particles, and then you perform operations. But you can define them to be, just say, the three-level amplitude, mm-hmm. and you perform these operations, and then you get the loop amplitude.
Mm. Is this related to Feynman's tree theorem?
Yeah, the Feynman tree theorem is something very interesting because you would say, well, there you also start with three amplitudes. You cut, you go to the forward limit, and then you build the amplitude out of that.
Right.
However, this is different in the sense that this will give the full loop amplitude, not even in terms of pieces that are integrated over just the D leaves or the Lorentz invariant phase space of a massless particle. This will actually give full loop momentum. So the way we integrate out these particles will produce a full four-dimensional loop momentum. Every time you integrate out two particles, you will produce a full loop momentum. In the Feynman tree theorem, you only produce an integral over the Lorentz invariant phase space of a massless particle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So this is a course. Okay? Of course, the central object is the Grassmannian formulation.
Yes. Well, that will be the subject of full lecture, so, yeah.
This is the overview, and that will be the end. Okay.
Any questions? If you don't have any questions, then we can all go. That, we're dogging one lecture. Okay, excellent. That's good. This was supposed to be an overview. If you didn't understand anything, that's great, because then because I succeeded in doing what I want.
Dependence on all external momentum?
Yes. Everything. Once again, I don't claim to have that we have obtained something new. It's a new formulation. So what we're going to get is the all loop amplitude, identical to the one that you will compute by painfully and carefully writing down all Feynman diagrams and computing them. Mm-hmm. So this is literally a new formulation. Now, what makes this manifest is that this will be a sum of terms where Yang-Yang invariance, this interdimensional algebra, is going to be manifest term by term. Now, if you want to preserve the Yang-Yang invariance, you will have to choose a contour that computes a leading singularity, and you will not get the loop amplitudes. Now, loop amplitudes end up breaking the Yang-Yang invariance. They make the Yang-Yang anomalous.
because infrared singularities will force you to regulate things in a way that will break the Young-Young invariance. So in a sense, we like to say that all loop corrections are there. They actually exist just because of the infrared divergence.
Are multiple mass scales. Is this a statement with respect to theories that have...
No, here in anyone's course of Young males, all you have to do is to go slightly to the Coulomb branch that does a perfectly fine regulator. No, what makes loop computations hard is just that the number of Feynman diagrams is incredibly large and
well, that's hard, but it's also the fact that when you have multiple different mass scales.
Yes, but here we don't worry about that. Right. In any case, for super young males, you just go slightly on the Coulomb branch and you only introduce one mass scale and you're done.
Mm.
In any case, for super young males, it's
okay. For this particular theory.
Yeah, for this. Okay. So,
we're done with the part you are not supposed to understand. Now, let's do the part that. Yeah, from now on, you're supposed to start understanding what I'm saying. Okay, we're going to be doing kinematics. Okay, so very good. So we're going back, forget about all this, where there is no Grassmannian, nothing fancy. We want to describe the scattering amplitude of n gluons. So you have to specify for each gluon the momentum of the gluon, the polarization vector of the gluon, and the color index of the gluon, okay? Say these are gluons, so we're doing just pure Young-Niels. So we're dealing with null vectors. Oh, I see. Very good. So we had a discussion until 3 in the morning last night, trying to figure out what notation to use. And I ended up giving up and agreeing with the other proposal for the notation, and I just used the wrong notation. I knew I was going to do it, but okay. So whenever you see an I, you can replace it by an A. Okay, I'll try to do that sometimes. You see, I should have used the fact that when there is a color index, the color index is defined by A, so that would have made my case. But okay, let's use I for the moment, for the particle index, okay? So the first thing that people did when you have amplitudes, when you have a scattering amplitudes that carry particles which carry a color index, is what is called a color decomposition. Okay? So what is that? Well, if you have Feynman diagrams, okay, at each vertex, you have an FAB, a structure constant, which you can write like this. Now, if you separate it, and then you contract indices when you sum over different particles, internal particles, and you use the fact that when you have a trace, imagine that we're doing UN gauge theory. Okay? If you're summing over B, this fuses the traces, right? That's probably familiar to everyone. These are two different statements. I'm saying that Feynman diagrams are made out of structure constants, which can be written like this. And then in the Feynman diagrams, you sum over the labels of the internal particles. And by using that in UN, summing over the label of an internal particle fuses the traces. You can show, or it's easy to see, that you can split the Feynman diagrams by the trace structure that they have in front. Okay, so you can pull out this trace structure and just write an n particle amplitude as a sum of terms where the trace structure is given by some particular ordering of the particles appearing in the trace. So let me use curly M for this, because I want to use keep using M for sigma here. It's nothing but a permutation of N elements, modular, cyclic permutations. Okay? Of course, the trace is cyclic, so we have to mod out by that, because otherwise we will get repeated things. But this is what we're going to do. This is called the color decomposition. And this is the object that is going to be easy to compute, or easier than the full object. And this is made out of what are called color order Feynman diagrams. What are these Feynman diagrams? Well, you can see that any Feynman diagram that has this color structure in front is a Feynman diagram that can be drawn on a plane, right? And the external particles, this is at tree level, okay, at tree level. And it's going to be true at loop level if you assume that we are in the planar limit, meaning that we're going to take the n of un to infinity, okay? So you can draw all Feynman diagrams on a plane, and then when you look at the external particles will be on the outside, and they will have a particular ordering given by the ordering that I choose here, okay? So the Feynman diagram, that's why it's going to be meaningful for me to draw something that looks like 1, 2, 3, and so on, all the way up to n, with this particular ordering. So this is the only one that I'll ever compute, 1 through n, in the canonical ordering. But I know that the full amplitude is given by the sum of all these terms dressed with the corresponding trace factor, summing over all permutations. Okay? So this object, m, of where particles 1, 2, and 3 are ordered in the canonical way, is the object we're going to compute. Okay. Now, as usual in physics, things can look very complicated or things can look very simple depending on the variables you choose. Why do I say what?
Finding n.
Yes, I said at three level, uh-huh. Or at all loops in the planar limit, we can just very easily put these guys on a plane and then define the color ordering by the location of the particles on the outside of the diagram.
At three level, we don't have double traces?
At three level, we don't have double traces. At higher loops, we have double traces, but we don't care about them, mm-hmm. At least during this week. All right, very good. So I was saying that
usually we can simplify things if you choose some magic variables. Okay? So you're probably familiar with the fact that the polarization vectors are not really vectors, right? If you want to have the S matrix to have the correct properties under Lorentz transformations, these vectors cannot be vectors. They have to do something funny. Under Lorentz transformations, they have to transform by as vectors, but they will also pick up a part which is proportional to the longitudinal part of the photon or the gluon. And then of course we invoke gauge invariance by saying, well, if you have the longitudinal part that cancels and so on. And that's the thing that gives the correct Lorentz invariant properties of that. But precisely that redundancy, that fact that the scattering amplitude must vanish when you have a longitudinal polarization vector in it, is what gives the complexity of Feynman diagrams. But it's also what makes locality manifest. So you can choose either be happy with locality and have extremely complicated answers, which will ensure this miraculous property, or give up locality and work with something that is manifestly gauge invariant and where you don't have this explosion of terms. And the first step to do that is to choose magic variables. And here are the variables. Okay, here I'll try to stick to our convention. Yeah, this is going to be tough. Well, but a promise is a promise. Okay. Let's see. You see, it's like against nature, so or at least mine. Okay. Imagine for particle. Okay. No. Well, even worse. Yes. Any particle, any momentum p. Imagine you're dealing with a momentum p that is a null vector. Okay. You have a null vector. This is great. So as a four vector, this is a quadratic equation. Okay? Well, it's a quadratic constraint. Imagine dealing with quadratic constraints all the time. That sounds a little bit hard. We would like to find variables where you can trivialize it. Okay? Well, the way we're going to do it is the following. We will take the momentum P, and we will contract it with the four vector made out of Pauli matrices. And here we go. Dave is going to laugh. Do you like this, Dave? Well, it should. You see? Wow. This is actually hurting. Well, note something interesting. So this is an exercise for you. When written like this, this is a 2x2 matrix, these A indices. Go from 1 to 2. The Pauli matrices are 2x2 matrices, right? And we talk about this spinor, these indices as being spinor indices, and this is a bi-spinor, right? So by this contraction, we have defined a bi-spinor. Now, the exercise is to show that p squared for any vector, doesn't have to be null vector, for any vector, p squared is proportional to the determinant of this matrix. Okay? Now, if p squared is 0, the determinant of this matrix is 0, right? And therefore, this guy, this matrix, 2x2 matrix, has rank 1. As a rank 1 matrix, we can write it as the tensor product of two vectors in C2. So each of these lambdas and lambda tildes are vectors or points. These are points in C2. But they are really, under the Lorentz group, they are the spinors of negative and positive chirality. Okay? Whenever I say a spinor, sometimes people jump and immediately think that we're doing Grassmann, that these guys must be anti-commuting variables, but they are not. Remember, these are just regular spinor representations of the Lorentz group. There is, they don't have to be Grassmann value objects. These are just each of these guys are just complex numbers, okay? Now, why are these magic variables? You might wonder. Well, apart from the fact that they make the on-shell condition of the momenta completely manifest, well, I usually say that there is a price to pay for that. And the price, before telling you what is nice about these variables, I'll tell you what price you have to pay and see if you're willing to pay, is that the map now you see that it's more natural to the prime somehow. But the map from P to lambdas and lambda tildes is not invertible. In other words, if you're given the momentum, can you uniquely tell me what lambda and lambda tilde is? I mean, can you define a unique set of lambdas and lambda tildes that correspond to a particular momentum? Well, the answer is no. And it's easy to see that, of course, if you take lambda, lambda tilde, the set that one solution of this equation that you find, well, I can always rescale lambda by some complex number t and lambda tilde by t inverse, and we get the same p. That's the price you pay. You introduce a redundancy in the description. Now, it turns out that this is quite nice. It's actually not a bad thing to have this redundancy. So this is actually nice. Because imagine that under a Lorentz transformation, imagine that you apply a Lorentz transformation on the S matrix, right? So some unitary operator on the one particle states. Then I told you that you have to go through a lot of pain there in order to ensure the correct Lorentz transformations with the polarization vectors. And it turns out that in these new magic variables, all you have to do is the following. You can say, well, I have this redundancy. So why don't I declare that under a Lorentz transformation, I'll define the lambda associated to the little lambda associated to the new p, or the new state with the new momentum, to be e to the minus I h, sorry, minus I half theta, where theta is a little group transformation induced by this Lorentz transformation. So we'll call it lambda p. And the usual Lorentz transformation acting on the spinner with the corresponding transformation given by the fact that it's a spinner of negative chirality. And the same thing for the lambda tilde, but now with a minus sign, a relative minus sign. Now, this means something interesting. It means that, first of all, as we know, we can make Lorentz invariant inner products of the spinners, okay, of the regular spinners. Forget about the new definition for the, with the lambda p. Just of the regular spinners, we can make Lorentz invariant products as follows. We can contract, imagine you're given two spinners for particle A and particle B, say. You can contract the lambdas, the corresponding lambdas with the antisymmetric 2x2 matrix epsilon to produce a Lorentz invariant object, which people like to call AD. So this is something that you will see very often in these lectures. And you can also do the same thing with AB dots for the positive chirality objects. And this is the node that's AB. Now, the correct Lorentz transformations of the S matrix tells you that under a little group transformation or under a Lorentz transformation, the S matrix should pick up a factor that depends on the helicity of each of the particles. Now, once we have made this definition, we can see that all we have to impose is that the S matrix, or our scattering amplitude M, be a function of our Lorentz invariant inner products of spinners, okay? But with the correct homogeneity, with a under our transformation what do I mean by the correct homogeneity? Well, if you have particle A, and you perform this transformation, you should require that the S matrix, or you should require that the scattering amplitude transforms as follows. So you have your set PA, A, P inverse A, and the tilde A. and this should be equal to Ta to the minus 2 times the helicity, you see, of the particle A. Okay? So this, just by writing any function that is a function of the Lorentz invariant inner products of the magic variables, and requiring that it has this transformation property under a rescaling, you have constructed an object that transforms correctly under the Lorentz group as an S-matrix element. So that's quite remarkable, because we didn't have to suffer what one has to suffer with the polarization vectors. Now we can just throw away polarization vectors or tensors if you are doing gravity, for all, because here nothing depends on the value of the helicity. We could be doing plus minus 2. And replace and talk about the scattering amplitudes as being functions for each particle. All you have to tell me is a pair of spinners and the helicity of the particle. Excellent. In Young Mills, yes. H is plus minus 1. Of course, in GR, H will be plus minus 2. And we're going to be doing N equals 4 for Young Mills. And H is going to be less or equal than 1 with all values, with all half integer values allowed. Very good. So let me give you an example so that you see the scattering amplitude that people computed in the 80s that led them to believe that there was something very remarkable happening. But sadly, it was very, very hard to generalize. In fact, it wasn't. It was considered to be somehow an exception. And this is called the Park-Taylor amplitude. Okay, let me just recap a little bit. So remember, we're doing this color decomposition. The full amplitude is really the sum over all these terms. We are stripping out the color structure. So we are only computing this particular term that is made out of Feynman diagrams that are color order. In other words, we can draw them on the plane. Say at three level, we can draw them on a plane and be dealing with a particular structure with a particular ordering of the external particles as being drawn as the external guys on the picture, okay? And by conventions, everybody deals with just the standard ordering, 1 to n, but everybody understands that once you compute this, you're supposed to put it here and sum over all permutations, okay? Now I'm going to write the Park-Taylor amplitude, which is an amplitude in the case where you have particle 1 with plus 1 helicity, particle 2 with plus 1 helicity. In fact, everybody will have plus helicity, except for particle I, which will have minus helicity, and particle J, which will have minus helicity as well. Okay. Well, it turns out that even for five particles, if you write down Feynman diagrams, you will have to compute many, many Feynman diagrams. Say, for six particles, you have to compute hundreds of Feynman diagrams. Now, you do that with your polarization vectors, and you are very happy with your formula. Now you translate into the magic variables, and you try to simplify and simplify and simplify. And at the end, I guarantee you, you will find something like this in terms of the magic variables. And that's the answer. Sorry? Yes. We're getting there. So that is the sum of Feynman diagrams. Now, of course, we know that part of the Poincaré group, there is a translation part of the Poincaré group, right? We can use translations. And the fact that the S-matrix must be invariant under translations actually means that the S-matrix cannot just be a rational function. It actually has to be a distribution. It's a distribution that is localized on the space of momenta that satisfy momentum conservation. Okay? Now, this is a full Park-Taylor amplitude. In a moment, we will see that this factor here, which looks a little bit funny, is actually a reflection, or is actually coming from the super partner of momentum conservation. So if you supersymmetrize momentum conservation, you don't even have to write this factor here. It actually comes from the supersymmetric version of the delta function, which, as we will see, we will be able to write explicitly by introducing Grassmann parameters as follows. And when you pick up a particular component, say, to compute a particular helicity amplitude, you can pick up this factor or different factors depending on which particle contains as positive and negative helicities. Or this formula with this supersymmetric delta function will encode every possible scattering amplitude that will contain, say, scalars, gauginos, or the gluons with different helicities. Okay? But we will get there. Any questions?
All right.
Wait, these factors, you haven't really defined what that is.
Okay, so just we have it.
The fact that we have some cyclic structure is coming from here. Yes, that's right. So each momentum there from the top, I need the hockey stick. But, well, oh, that's what this is for. No, this is not for that. So if we have null vectors, we can write the null vectors by contracting with the Pauli matrices as 2x2 matrices. The determinant of the matrix is actually proportional to the norm square of the vector. If you're dealing with null vectors, then it's a matrix of rank 1, which can be written as a tensor product of two vectors, right? These are lambdas and lambda tildes, and they are actually spinors under the Lorentz group. Then for each particle, we will give a couple. All the data that we need is lambda and a lambda tilde for each particle. Out of them, we can make Lorentz invariant inner products, just with the lambdas or with the lambda tildes. Now, this is fantastic. This guy looks like holomorphic, in a sense, right? Because you see that in order to have real peace, this is an observation, in order to have real momenta, this implies that lambda tilde must actually be related to the complex conjugate of the lambda of the corresponding particle. The plus minus sign depends on whether the particle is future directed or past directed. Okay? And this is precisely the condition we're about to relax. Precisely going back to your question, are you doing real momenta for external particles? Well, the reason we're going to relax that is we're going to study the simplest possible amplitudes. And these are the three particle amplitudes. Well, you would say, I mean, of course they are simple. They are zero, right? We all know that if you scatter massless particles, you get zero. Three particle amplitudes of massless particles must be zero. Now, let me review a little bit why we usually say that this is true. Well, the reason we say is that, well, of course, momentum conservation tells you that this is true. Now, just put P3 on this side and square the equation. Well, P3 is a null vector. Therefore, P1 dot P2 must be zero. Okay? Now do the same thing. Put P1 on this side and square the equations. You will find that P2 dot P3 is zero, and then P1 dot P3 is also zero, likewise. So there are no kinematic invariants, so it must be zero. Okay? Now here is another exercise for you. This is a mini course, so you guys are supposed to have homework. Right? So I'll check the homework tomorrow, by the way. So you're supposed to. So the second exercise is to show that if you have a vector PA dot PB, okay, in our magic variables, of course, we know how to compute this contracting the mu indices, right? But this is not exciting. We have new variables, so we should translate everything we know into the new variables. So we have PA dot PB, and your homework is to show that this, which is a quadratic equation, actually factorizes in these new variables. It's quite remarkable. It factorizes. It gives you AB times AB. Of course, you can immediately do the exercise by saying, well, we know this is zero group invariant, right? And it must be made out of Lorentz invariant inner products, So this is all it can be. So your exercise is to compute the proportionality constant. Don't be smart. Okay. Now, these conditions, we're finding that the free particle amplitude, pi dot pj, or ad, happen to be zero. But what we now have a factorization here. So we seem to have two solutions. We can set all the square brackets to zero, or all the angular brackets to zero. You'd say, no. You're out of luck, because this condition tells you that one will imply the other, right? Everything will be zero. But, well, you know, three particle amplitudes, who knows? Maybe they are useful. Let's complexify momenta. Okay? Now this is not true anymore. So we can have all angular brackets being non-zero and set all these guys to zero and satisfy momentum conservation. Or we can also do the other way around. So that means that three particle amplitudes are actually holomorphic. Okay? Let's see how bad this is. Now this is great because I told you how scattering amplitudes are supposed to transform under depending on the helicity of the particles, right? Now if I tell you that I have something that is only holomorphic, I cannot make anything that is invariant under the Lyrow group transformations, right? There is no way of making something that has helicity zero. Therefore, by only imposing the homogeneity transformations, I should be able to determine the scattering amplitude uniquely. And I haven't said the word free level. That means that whatever we compute is true to all orders in perturbation theory. So the free particle amplitude is actually computed in one go to all orders in perturbation theory. So let me give you an example. Well, how do you make something that is only a function? So from our argument, this can only be either a function of the angular brackets or a function of the square brackets. Right? From momentum conservation, we can only have one or the other. Now, well, we need something that transforms. If we rescale the lambdas and lambda tildes of this, the way we have it on the blackboard here on top, we're supposed to plug in HA minus 1 for these two particles, and we're supposed to have minus 2 for this particle. Well, it's not hard to see that this would be, that this is a unique solution, in fact. For this one, and here, you should have okay. Well, there is a proportionality constant here, which we could call the coupling constant. Now, which solution, which of the two is physical and which one is not physical? Well, the one that is physical is probably the one that does what we all expect, or the one that we have seen in nature, right? We don't see three particles, the scattering amplitude. We don't see three particle amplitude, two guys going into another massless guy all the time, popping all over the place, right? So we are definitely sure that for real momentum, this amplitude should vanish, right? So that's a boundary condition somehow in the space of kinematic invariance. When we set the kinematic invariance to be those of real momentum, we should get zero. Now this one gives zero. But this one blows up. So this is unphysical, so we have to set this to zero. So this is not there. And we have computed an amplitude to all orders in perturbation theory in one go. That's very good. How about the scattering amplitude where you have one, something like this? Well, I leave it as an exercise, but it should be easy to realize that it's nothing but something like this. Okay? That's a unique solution. Okay. Now you see that, well, you know, it's not going to be a surprise because that's why I gave you the overview. These BCFW recursion relations I told you about, they allow you to construct scattering amplitudes from smaller scattering amplitudes. So you could go on and on and on, okay, and reduce everything to three particle amplitudes. Of course, if the recursion relations are using physical on-shell scattering amplitudes, and if the recursion relations were using the external particles as regular real momenta, that would be a silly statement because we would conclude that everything is zero because we can reduce it to three particle amplitudes, which are zero. However, I told you that BCFW, we deform particles in a non-local way. In particular, we make them complex. So the three particle amplitudes that will fit in the whole recursion relations are actually evaluated at complex momenta. Even though the external particles are all real and nice, the ones that our friends at the LHC will give us as data, they are all completely nice and real, but the building blocks will be evaluated at complex momenta. And we have just discovered that they are completely uniquely defined. So the whole theory is defined completely by asking the correct transformations under Lorentz under Poincaré. So Poincaré determines the whole structure of Young Mills and gravity in one go without any, without any room for something else.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So that's assuming that the BCFW equations are true. Now, that's what the Grassmannian will make manifest. Right. Excellent question.
Yeah.
Very good. So we're only supposed to do supersymmetry and BCF in the last 5 minutes. So. let's do. You see, the number of, if you're given n, the number of scattering amplitudes that you have to compute is huge because you have all the possibilities with plus, minus, minus, plus, all possible combinations here and there and so on. That's definitely a little bit of a pain. And in fact, you can think about supersymmetry. If you don't like supersymmetry very much, because you say, well, it's not manifestly realized in nature, even worse, any force projections is definitely, well, maybe a trick, some people would say. we can think about this as a bookkeeping device, if you wish. Okay? It's a way of putting everything together into a single object. So, in any force projections, we have four supercharges. We have, so I want to get the indices right. So the I index goes from 1 to 4. And of course, this is really supposed to be an
A dot and A index. These are the spinor indices, right? So these are our supercharges. And we can define ground states so that if you have plus 1 helicity, and one particle state with plus 1 helicity, you get 0 when acting with Q bar. Sorry. If you have minus 1, or you can define also ground state using of the Q operator using the top component of the supermultiplet with plus 1 helicity. Okay, this is in Young Mills. If we were doing supergravity, we would replace this by 2. Okay. Very good. And the number of supercharges, the index will go all the way to A. Okay. Now we can generate the full supermultiplet by acting on the one by acting with the, in this case, with a raising operator Q on this ground state. Okay. Well, in fact, so let me put just a general spin S so we know what happens if you apply this on a general spin S. We just increase the helicity by half, okay? And this thing is what is called the SU. In this case, it's SUN, which is 4, R symmetry index. Okay? Very good. We could also use a Q bar operator. Yeah. I have to follow my notes, otherwise I'll violate the 3 a.m. conventions of of notation that we had yesterday night. So okay, very good. Now, an exercise for you, which again I'll check tomorrow, is to build the full n equals 4 and, if you have energy, n equals 8 super multiplex. And study their corresponding R symmetry properties. Okay? That's actually a nice exercise. Now, for our purposes, what we need I mean here s equals 1. So here is 1. So your exercise is to keep applying this and producing higher order tensors, okay, until you reach the singlet on the other end of the spectrum. Okay. Very good. Now, in order to talk about all particles at the same time, we are going to define a superparticle or a coherent state. Okay. And now this is going to be something that will depend on the lambda and the lambda tilde of the corresponding particle that we're going to describe. Now, it's not going to depend on the helicity of the one particle state, because we're going to put all helicities together. So instead, it's going to depend on a continuous parameter, which is a Grassmann parameter. Okay? And it's defined as a coherent state. Acting on the ground state. Okay? Where this is a reference spinner. Which really will not make any appearance in any of the computations we will do, but it has to be introduced in order for this expression to make sense. And it's defined so that this is normalized to 1. Okay. Very good. So now we can describe a full superparticle or the full supermultiplet using this Grassmann parameter eta tilde, okay, which has a lower I index. But instead, we could also define a coherent state starting with the Q operator instead of the Q bar operator and define a state that is parameterized by an eta parameter, which now will have the R charge index on top. But these are just equivalent representations. One can go from one to the other by performing a Grassmann Fourier transform. Of the particular state. Okay? So, in these lectures, sometimes we will use the eta tilde representation or the eta representation, but we know that we can also mix them in the same amplitude. We can describe some particles with the eta representation, some particles with the eta tilde representation. But now, something that is nice is that you see that we don't have to talk about plus or minus helicity particles. They are all encoded, or they are all in the same supermultiplet. So, our one particle states or our amplitudes are now smooth objects. We don't have any discreteness. The final observation that I would like to make today is the following. Just as translations in space-time, just an element of the Poincaré group, led us to the conclusion that amplitudes were distributions supported on the set of momenta satisfying momentum conservation, here, supersymmetry, likewise, or translations in superspace, will imply that our amplitude, now given in terms of so supersymmetry implies that the amplitude must be invariant under a supersymmetric transformation. And when you apply the supersymmetric transformation, what happens is that you pick up a supertranslation which is of the form it would be impossible to get all the indices right if you change conventions the same day. The prefactor of the sum is just the supersymmetric translation parameter. Now, for an amplitude to be invariant or satisfy this property, this is just equivalent of e to the I a dot p, right? Or the sum over the p's. Yeah, you see a is what? On the here. This is equal to this, in fact. It's the same m here and the same m here. That's the statement of invariance. Yeah, it looks strange, right? So let me write the same equation for momentum conservation. Yes, invariance under translations tells you that m of lambda lambda tilde must be the same as e to the I, the translation in space-time parameters, say d, the sum of the momenta pi, of a from 1 to n, times m. Let's even remove the lambdas and lambda tildes. Let's say depends on the momentum, PA, or PBs. This is a statement that the S matrix is invariant under translations. Well, how can this be possible? This looks like a crazy question. This is only possible if M is a distribution. Yeah, so if this is only possible if M is a distribution So we usually say that this is zero, but in general, as distributions, the most general solution to this equation is, in fact, this equation. Likewise, the most general solution to this equation is putting in here a delta function that sets this to zero. But no, you have four components here, and A has two components. So this is the A that I wrote here, lambda, lambda, tilde. So just declaring that our amplitude possesses this, contains this delta function, ensures invariance under supersymmetry. And now, here it is, the supersymmetric part Taylor formula. Okay? So all helicities, everything that you want, in this particular R charge sector, is given in this formula. Now, what is this R charge sector? And that's the only thing that I have to define so that we conclude with the lecture today. And Nima can take over this afternoon and go on until tomorrow. It's just to rewrite what I just erased. This doesn't look very beautiful. So we want to do it, we want to write it supersymmetrically. Okay, so we have now it's supersymmetrically, so we're supposed to put together the two different kinds of scattering amplitudes into a single object. How can we do that? Well, it turns out that it's not that difficult. You can write the holomorphic part. The holomorphic part is just an example of the Park-Taylor formula. So it's just given by this, from 1 to 3. Now it's very, very beautiful. It's manifestly cyclic invariant. Right? Cyclicity has been restored because there is no plus minus ones anywhere. So all the particles are on the same footing. Now the other one is actually written, nicely written, in the opposite representation where you have etas instead of eta tildes and square brackets instead of angular brackets, as we know. But it's funny to have different representations in the same object. In fact, so I just given that this is a function of lambda tildes, but I told you how to go from one representation to the other. All we have to do is to integrate, to perform a Fourier transform, or a Grassmann Fourier transform, on every particle. and we're done. So this is the three-particle amplitude, fully supersymmetric. Okay? And finally, all I have to do is to define what I mean by the R charge. And what I mean is the following. If you take all particles for all A, and you rescale lambda by, sorry, and you keep the lambdas fixed, the lambda tildes fixed, and you rescale only the eta parameters of every particle by some T, you can easily see that in this case, we will pick up a factor. In general, we will pick up a factor that looks like T to the A times K, to the K power, and this is going to be called the R charge. Well, a quick exercise for you is to show that our three-particle amplitude is actually the sum of a term that has k equals 2 plus a term that has k equals 1. All right? So I have given you the full supersymmetric building block of all the scattering amplitudes at three level at least in n equals 4 superjamians. Very good. Let's see. What am I supposed to do? Oh, we're only supposed to do twister space, but we don't have time to twister space. No. Okay. I think this is a good time. This is a good point to stop. All right? Thank you.